good afternoon. I'm William Lester, Professor of Chemistry and Chair of the Hitchcock Professorship Committee. On behalf of the Hitchcock Professorship, we're pleased to welcome Sir John Gurdon as this year's speaker in the Charles M. and Martha Hitchcock Lecture Series. Sir John Gurdon's groundbreaking studies in nuclear transplantation galvanized effort to clone a mammal from an adult cell, a quest that in 1996 produced a healthy sheep named Dolly. The intellectual driving force behind the success was Gurdon's discovery that cells of the body are capable of differentiating into all cell types of a vertebrate animal. Gurdon provided unprecedented evidence that nuclear transplantations from specialized cells could give rise to adult, fertile, genetic copies of their donor. His findings also yielded wide-ranging medical implications for the use of stem cells in tissue therapy. Gurdon recently revisited this field to study nuclear reprogramming and cell fate determination in amphibians. Gurdon was born on October 2, 1933, in Dippenhall, England, and entered Christ Church College at Oxford University, intending to study classics. He transferred to the Department of Zoology, earning his PhD in embryology in 1960. Following postdoctoral work at the California Institute of Technology and a six-month sabbatical at the Carnegie Institution in Baltimore, in 1965, Gurdon returned to Oxford University. In 1971, he moved to the Medical Research Council's Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, subsequently becoming head of the Cell Biology Division. He was appointed Professor of Cell Biology in the University of Cambridge in 1983 and served as Master of Magdalen College, Cambridge from 1995 to 2002. Gurdon is an active researcher at the Wellcome Trust Cancer Research UK Gurdon Institute of Cancer and Developmental Biology and served as its first chairman from 1988 to 2001. Sir John Gurdon's international awards and honors include the Albert Broccher Prize of the Belgian Royal Academy in 1968, the Royal Medal in 1985, and the Copley Medal 2003 of the Royal Society of London. The International Prize for Biology from Japan, 1987, the Wolf Prize in Medicine, 1989, and the Conklin Medal of the Society for Developmental Biology in 2001. He is a fellow of the Royal Society and a foreign member of numerous academies, including the Academia Europa, American Philosophical Society, United States National Academy of Sciences, and Institute of Medicine, and the Académie des Sciences, Institute de France. Please join me in welcoming Sir John Gurdon.
So thank you indeed, Dean Mason and Professor Lester, for this most welcome invitation to give these two talks. I'm told that one of my predecessors was someone called Joseph Needham, and he was a great expert on Chinese history and particularly on Chinese painting, which in historic times was mostly done with a paintbrush, including their writing. Now, Joseph Needham enjoyed the reputation of a very focused approach to his subjects, and he was well known to have offered a course of 5 one-hour lectures entitled The History of the Brush. Now, that's a more focused approach than I plan to take today and tomorrow, when I would like to talk about the... There we are. No, we're not. This is... Oh, there. Thank heavens, yes. I'm so nervous of these computer things, they may not work. So I'm going to talk today about the process by which an egg makes an early embryo, and then a later embryo, and finally an adult. And in the case of mammals, it's possible to take these early embryo cells, place them in culture, and they're called embryonic stem cells, implant them back into an embryo and then grow eventually an adult. And so one goes from an egg, a fertilized egg, through the early developmental stages so that you end up with a range of specialized cells, such as blood and skin and these other things of which we consist. Now, there are three approaches that are often used in this kind of work, which are aimed at telling us how early in development cells actually take decisions. When do the early embryonic cells decide what they are going to become in development? And these three approaches are essentially the following. One is to take the early embryo and to mark a few of those cells and simply follow them through and ask what they become. This is called lineage studies. And if you mark cells in that part of an embryo, they will become the backbone, sometimes called notochord, of the embryo. That's really just to tell you what the normal history of these early cells is. And then the second approach is often called specification, where you mark the same cells, but then you take them out of the rest of the embryo and grow them in culture and ask what they become. In many cases, these cells already know what they're going to become, and so they will become backbone, often called notochord, in spite of the fact that they have been taken out of the embryo and receive no information from the cells around them. And then the third approach is called determination, where you again mark these cells at that part of the embryo, but you then transplant them into another part of another embryo, a different part. And if these cells really know what they're going to be, if they've made up their mind to follow a particular fate, you will find that these cells again become backbone in a secondary embryo already formed on top of the first. Those are the basic procedures by which one can follow the early decisions that cells take. And one of the lessons I'm going to talk about is the fact that cells take a very early decision, even a few hours after they're formed, as to what they're going to become. They're very committed to their future career. Now, one can demonstrate this rather easily by putting a little mark on a fertilized egg at one particular point, actually the point just below where sperm enters. And when you grow those eggs into, in this case, tadpoles, you can barely see it here, but there is a blue mark just under the tail on each of these larvae. It shows that that particular bit of the egg already knows, just as the one cell stage, what it should become in the rest of life. This is called the lineage analysis. One can actually, interestingly, follow lineage analysis of scientists. And when you do this, you find that there's a famous early scientist called Boveri, of whom a student was Spemann, one of the most famous embryologists there are. Of him, a student was Balzer. This is now in Switzerland, of whom there was a student called Hadorn, well known to Drosophila embryologist, and so you go down until you get to Professor Richard Harland, who is my host. Now, whether he knows or not that he was a great, 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 great scientific grandchild of Boveri, I'm not quite sure, but it's an interesting fact that a large number, perhaps even nearly all, of the European people in this field trace back to one individual, in this case, Boveri. So that exemplifies the principle of lineage. Now, what I'm going to do in this talk is to try and cover four points, be talking a little bit about the pre-fertilization control of development. Interestingly, an awful lot of what happens as we form from an egg takes place even before fertilization. I shall then talk a bit about what we call asymmetric cell division, and that's one of the two fundamental mechanisms by which different kinds of cells are formed. The other of these two mechanisms is called signaling between cells, and I shall talk about that later, and finally something about the so-called community effect. So that's what I want to talk about. And to start off with then, talking about pre-fertilization control of development, and that really has to do with what information exists in the egg and the sperm before they actually meet each other. Now, this topic was of interest to people a long time ago, and I'm quoting here from Hartsucker, 1694, and as a matter of fact, Joseph Needham, to whom I've referred, was a well-known historian of embryology. He shows this picture of what was seen at the time to be a clear view of the sperm. And if you look carefully, you can see more or less a complete adult with the arms neatly folded round the legs of this individual, which was imagined to be present in the sperm, and they thought that's how people actually arose. Now, that's no longer believed to be the case once we had better microscopes, so things have moved on from then. But I do want to talk about a very early experiment which is largely overlooked at the present time, and this has to do with snails. Now, this diagram looks complicated, but actually it's not actually complicated at all, and it relates to the fact that snails come with a coil, and you can call them right-handed snails or left-handed snails, depending which, when you look down from the top, the spiral goes one way or another. Now, back in the 1920s, people began investigating this, and they found a rather curious effect, that if you cross this is a left-handed snail, can barely read the writing, I'm afraid, and that is a right-handed snail, you see they coil different ways. When you do that, all of the offspring actually become left-handed snails. And when you cross the two left-handed snails, all of their offspring become right-handed snails. A very complicated situation. But it was managed to be interpreted at that time correctly that all that really matters is the genetic composition of the mother. So in this case, they call it a small DD, meaning sinistral, and when the mother is of that kind, all her offspring will have the left-handed coil, irrespective of what the snail's husband might have been. And likewise, in this case, you have this snail, which has a genetic constitution of a right-handedness, and all their offspring will be right-handed snails. And this was worked out at that time in 1920, and it was the very first example where it was shown that the mother's constitution actually determines the major characteristics of all her offspring. So there's a maternal inheritance in this case of the handedness of the individual. The whole symmetry is changed round. Rather a remarkable case. Now, I quote that for a couple of reasons, and I rather like the original paper, where you couldn't do this nowadays. They show a picture of the South Yorkshire Malacological Society on a Sunday outing at King Lane Pond, Leeds, where it so happened that these left-handed snails are extremely abundant. They're actually otherwise very rare. So this was obviously not a well-subscribed society with, as far as I can see, about 10 members neatly spaced around this small puddle outside Yorkshire. It's nice that in those days you could publish a picture of that kind of thing in the middle of your paper. The other thing that's particularly interesting about this particular work is that one of the people who did it was a man called Captain Diver. Captain because he was an army man, and he had a career in the parliamentary service. So he worked for 6 months of the year as an administrator in Parliament, in the government circles, and for the other 6 months he grew snails in his private house in jam jars. And he actually did the key experiments working out how this all happened. And he actually was an amateur. He was not trained as a scientist. And it's therefore interesting that one of the fundamental discoveries about maternal inheritance was actually achieved by an amateur who had no scientific training at all. And it makes the point that there is, in fact, a role for amateur scientists. Now, I'm now going to turn to the second point, part of my talk, and this is the process called asymmetric cell division. We know that people, animals, including ourselves, have three axes. There's the anterior-posterior axis, and this is largely determined by your mother's composition. The second axis is the dorsoventral axis, the back, the front. That, as we'll see, is largely determined, most cases, by an environmental influence, such as where the sperm enters. The third axis, the difference between left and right, is particularly interesting, but actually we do not still understand the mechanism of how a completely bilaterally symmetrical cell can somehow consistently form two equal cells, mirror images of each other, and yet one will always be the left-handed side and the other the right. Why is the heart on the left? We don't actually understand that either now. But we do know this principle, and that's illustrated here by looking at cells. Here's a cell, and it makes some products, which are shown as the red spots, and usually these cells have something on one side, like another cell or a membrane, and as a result, these products go to one side of the cell, the one distal from that substrate. And when the cell divides, most of these products go into one daughter cell, not the other. So it's an asymmetric division. And the one that gets most of them will then follow a differentiated fate, for example, becoming a nerve cell, and the other one remains as a stem cell, and later on will divide again to make another kind of asymmetric division. That being one important example of this process. Now, the other person who contributed a great deal to this was Conklin, dating from his early work was actually in about 1905, and he worked with a marine organism called Styela, and he established the important principle that this egg has, as it happens, a little bit of yellow pigment, which when you follow it through, always ends up in the tail muscle of the larva. So it's a yellow cytoplasm correlates with tail muscle determination. And that was an important principle established some 100 years ago by careful observation, and again illustrates this important principle that something is localized in the very earliest stages of development which commits the embryo organism to follow a certain kind of fate. Then there are the eggs of amphibians, which happen to be conveniently colored, black on the top and white underneath. And a really important work by one of your colleagues, John Gerhardt, established some years ago that the fundamental principle here was that there is a polarity in one direction, and this is set up maternally, and the sperm generally enters at one side, and opposite it, it forms a special structure, which this is called the Newcoupe Center, after one of the famous embryologists, and there's a rotation, and at this point, the cells start entering the embryo, and they make the main axis. So this illustrates the fundamental principle that you have a maternal polarity on top of which there is an environmental polarity which is at right angles to it, and so you establish the first two axes. Now, mammals, like ourselves, often thought to be a different principle. This is a mammal egg, and they're difficult to work with because they're extremely small. You may not know that the egg of a mouse, a human, and an elephant are all exactly the same size, about 70 microns across. And it has been thought for a long time that these eggs have no preformed maternal polarity because you actually can't see any. They look completely even. but in fact, there are experiments by my colleague Magdalena Zernicker-Gertz, who has done some remarkable experiments with these eggs, where you divide out the cells and you collect the ones that are in a certain position in relation to the result of fertilization. And the main point is the green, blue, and red embryos derived from this follow completely different fates. But I show this for another reason, because the manipulations involved in this process are actually quite striking. And we're going to see how you have to do these things. In this case, this is a very fine micropipette, which is going to pick up a fluorescent bead and attach it to one point on the embryo. And this is actually a mouse egg, but it would look exactly the same if it was a human egg. This is now a pipette which will pull that cell away from the rest of the embryo. You see it being dragged away, and massive distortion, but amazingly the embryos survive. This one is actually taking a cell away from the rest of the embryo, and you can now see they focus and prepare to pull another cell away. That's one of the manipulations which can be done and could just as well be done with humans, and indeed that is the process used when you take a cell from a human embryo, one cell, and test it for, say, a genetic disease. If you're looking for cystic fibrosis patients, that's a very good way of identifying them. And amazingly, you can pull off one cell from the very early stages when there are only about eight, and the rest of the embryo survives. Now, what we have not been able to see so far is the other video. Yes, this may do it. This is now putting the one I meant to show first. The pipette pushes right into that egg. It's amazing how it can tolerate this huge deformation. It's then going to pick up a fluorescent bead, and now you can begin to see these beads waiting around there. And in a moment, the pipette here, which is extremely small, will come along and will pick up one of these beads on the tip, barely see it there, and then it will push this again right inside that egg. It's amazing what these eggs will tolerate. There it goes, right inside, about to go right inside, dig in, completely distort it, and leave the bead on the outside. And we'll see in a moment that that is, since it's marked fluorescently, you will suddenly see this brightly coloured fluorescent bead sitting on the outside, which enables you to mark one particular part of that embryo and hence to follow its fate. So these are the kinds of things which amazingly can be done, I think, with these small eggs, extraordinarily tolerant to manipulation. Now, the last example of asymmetric divisions is this one with a colleague, Andrea Brand, who works with the future nerve cells. The red is the nucleus, and the green you can see is a determinant. It's molecules which actually tell the daughter cells what to become. And in the video, brief video we'll see in a moment, you'll see that the green is all segregated to one of the two daughter cells. It all goes to one side. Now, if you watch quickly, the green has all gone to that side and it gets into that cell. It's very short, not the other one. So this is a living image of the movement of the partitioning of that material into one of the two daughter cells, which then tells it what it should become. So the conclusion from that part of the talk is simply to say that one of the fundamental mechanisms of how we start life as eggs and turn into individuals is this idea that cells, a parental cell, puts its key molecules into one of the two daughter cells, and that then tells that daughter cell what fate it should become. In this case, it distinguishes a nerve cell from the parental stem cell. So now the third part of the talk concerns signaling between cells, and this is the second fundamental mechanism by which different kinds of cells are formed. And the simplest possible form of this process is called a simple threshold signaling. Cells have to be close together, and the whole process is independent of time and concentration. And the principle is this, that you have a so-called responding cell and another cell that sends out signals, and this cell comes adjacent to that one, sends signals to this cell, which now follows a new cell fate. And it does that because it receives signals, signal molecules, some of which we know, from a nearby cell. A rather simple process, and it doesn't really matter how much information it gets. As long as it gets enough that exceeds a threshold, it will follow this new fate. So that's a simple form of signaling. But there are more complex forms, and the one that I'll talk about for a few minutes is the following one, and this is called signaling by a morphogen gradient. I talked about this in some detail yesterday, but I'm going to just summarize the main principles today. And the idea is this, that you have a part of an embryo, often named after Newcoup or Spemann, the people I mentioned early on, where cells emit a signal, and the signal they emit are these little red spots that you may just be able to see around a cell called A, which is next to the source. In a little bit longer, and it's typically an hour or two, more of these signal molecules have been released, and they spread further away from the source so as to surround the second cell in the row, which now follows fate A because it gets the low concentration of them. And later still, say 3 hours later, yet more of these molecules have been formed, and they now reach the third cell away from the source, which again follows A. Now, the cell that was near the source first decides to become A, and then it changes its mind and decides to become B, and finally it might change its mind and become C. And the reason why this process is so important is that one signal coming from this center can tell several cells what they should become, whether they become, say, nerve or heart or gut or anything, and the position of those cells is related to where the signal comes from. So it's a very fundamental, important process. Now, much of this work happens to have been done with amphibia, frogs, and it's interesting to reflect for a moment as to why it should be or how it came about that the frog commonly used for this work is a South African frog. And when you go back in history, you find that the first description of this, incorrectly called Buffo, was in 1803 by a French museum worker who never saw the animal alive, but he received one through the post and drew a picture of it. And the interesting thing is that the only really striking feature of this animal, which is called Xenopus, which means strange claws, is that it should have claws on the feet, which he failed to observe. You'd have thought if you're given a dead frog and there's nothing much to look at except the fact that it has claws on the feet, you might actually have noticed it, but he didn't do that, and that's how it came into existence. But a bit later, people wanted to grow this animal, like you do for laboratory animals, and someone in, as it happens in Britain, then collected some animals and tried to grow them. Now, they're tropical animals, and he had a publication, the result of which was to show that if you have a Bunsen burner underneath a beaker with water, you can keep the animals inside that container. It's an unbelievably crude way of keeping animals warm, and I think any animal inspector in Britain, at least, would immediately disallow such a procedure. But nevertheless, that's how Mr. Bless came to add to his publications, by inventing that not very sophisticated procedure of keeping animals warm. Over the years, a number of people have worked on this, and this is a picture of a famous embryologist called Johannes Holtfreter, who was one of the students of Spemann. Spemann was a very austere person with a rigid personality, and Holtfreter was a rather lively student who was actually very famous because he discovered a way of preventing nearly all the embryos that Spemann worked with from dying. So Spemann's famous experiment, which got him a Nobel Prize, was to graft tissue from one embryo to another. Very elegant experiment, but the fact is that almost all the embryos died. I think 3 out of 150 showed the effect for which the Nobel Prize was awarded, the other 147 having died. And the reason they died was that they got infected. Now, Holtfreter was clever enough to think of making a solution actually out of chemicals from the shelf, so there weren't bacteria in it. but he had a lively personality, and much of his time was spent painting in Indonesia, which was his hobby. That infuriated Spemann, and so he disliked the Holt Frater and all his work. But nevertheless, that's who he was, and he was really very fundamental in enabling much of the experimental embryology now done today to actually take place. Now, using these sorts of methods, one can explore how cells signal to each other. And one of the crucial methods now is to take an embryo, separate all the cells in suspension, add to them some of these known growth factors, and there's one that happens to be called activin, for only 10 minutes. So you influence the cells, and then you wash off all the excess factor and put them together and grow them. And that's turned out to be a very informative way of establishing how cells respond to signals. One of the remarkable things now is that one particular molecule, member of the TGF-beta class, can be used to treat these embryo cells in suspension, and rather surprisingly, you can make almost every cell in the body just by treating these embryo cells for a few minutes with different concentrations of this factor. So if you use a low concentration, middle, high, or very high, you send cells in different directions, various genes are turned on, and you can see that you end up with blood, muscle, cartilage, or intestine. And that's a very important point, that by taking very early naive cells, and they really are very early, you can give them different amounts of the same substance and tell them to form totally different structures, which are the main components of our body. And this point will be quite relevant when I talk about the second part of this process tomorrow. But it does raise the question of how it is that a cell can perceive or interpret these different concentrations of factor. And the concentrations are extremely small, and only two- or three-fold changes in concentration will make the difference between, for example, heart or intestine or bone or blood. We can see this process working, in this example where these are beads, biochemical beads, treated with the factor, and they cause genes to be turned on in this group of cells. And when you increase the concentration, this gene response is further away from the source. So the strength of this signal will decide how far away this response occurs. Very much like throwing a stone into a pond. There's a ripple of gene response among these cells, and if you do it even stronger, the ripple reaches the edge, as it were, of the pond. And the point of saying this is that the same cells will respond in completely different ways to the same purified biochemical factor, same molecule. It gives us a lot of opportunity for determining the way embryo cells will develop and making the kind of cells we might wish them to form. One of the principles here is that these determinants, these factors shown as blue spots, disappear from move away from a source in the space in between cells. They bind to the matrix with very low affinity, and occasionally they find a receptor here on the cells to which they bind very tightly and will inform cells of the fate that they should follow. Now, this is, again, a rather remarkable process, which I'm going to explain in a little more detail by the use of, hopefully, of a video. If you take these cells, and this is just one such cell, and you treat them by adding this factor, this TGF-beta molecule called activin, for only 10 minutes, you find that the molecule in the cell which signals to the genes to tell it what it is, called SMAD2, goes into the nucleus, and that green patch is the presence of these molecules inside this cell. Now, you notice that for only a 10-minute treatment, the green molecules move in, and there they still are inside this cell as much as 4 or 5 hours later. And it turns out that these cells remember, curiously, the small amount of treatment they've had, and they will follow a fate, whether it's heart or liver or whatever else it is, simply according to the strength of that signal that they received for 10 minutes. So, enhancing the point I've just made, you can take these single cells, give them a very short treatment of some known factor. The factor actually is a gene product, now purified, and that very short experience of only 10-minute treatment will tell the cells what kind of fate they should follow. And this is the process called memory. And when you integrate this information, the way it seems to work is the following, that the cells receive this signal and they absorb it and they start responding to gene A, B, or C according to the strength. They then will remain at that level of response, what the level line means, until finally they won't receive the signal anymore. They become non-competent. They just won't receive it anymore and the signal goes down. Now, they have to remain expressing a constant response for some time to make enough of the product to guide the cells in the directions they eventually need to go. Now, I'm now going to try and explain how it is that this whole process works. And there's one fundamental principle here, and that is that what really matters is the concentration of this signal factor inside the nucleus of the cell, and it actually is the volume of that material which is passing within the cell to the genes. And I show these two pictures because they illustrate the point that the flow rate of something, the rate of flow, is not relevant here at all. It's the volume. Now, this rather splendid picture of the Victoria waterfalls coming from there, there's a substantial distance that the water is falling, and of course the rate at which that water falls will be more or less proportional to the height. There's a certain rate of flow, but in this case the source is very small. There's a little stream there and it will follow down, and the volume, though it looks considerable from this picture, is actually quite limited. Now, if we compare that waterfall to another one equally famous that you may have seen called the Iguazu Falls on the border of Paraguay and Uruguay and I think Brazil, the distance is the same, the height is the same, but the volume of water is absolutely immense. It falls right across that whole hillside and indeed round the corner. And it is the volume of flow that makes the difference in cells, and indeed these two examples would show the cells follow a completely different fate according to the volume of flow, not the rate of flow or anything else. Now, I have a video which explains this clearly, if the video shows, and it's going to work the following way. We have outside the cell these green objects, which are the signal factors coming from a source, and you'll see them coming from this side and moving across. And as they move, they have some chance of some of them finding a receptor. This is what they have to find. When they do find that, the red signal molecule, the one that was shown as bright green before, goes into the nucleus where it forms a concentration which is sufficient to turn on the appropriate gene, in this case A. In order to keep this working smoothly, something or other has to come along and remove all those molecules from outside the cell. There is a point in showing these butterflies, which you may wonder why they're being shown, and the point of doing so is that this concept of a morphogen gradient, concentration dependence, is actually applies fairly widely. Now, you may be able to see, perhaps, that these rather splendid undersides of butterflies have these brilliant ring spots with many ripples of colours in this particular species, and Nipam Patel is a great expert on this, but it seems almost certainly that this coloration in butterflies, fish, birds works by a morphogen gradient process by which cells sense a wave of molecules going past them and switch on genes accordingly. And I draw this one because, to me, this is really interesting problem in the future. One is to understand how could these complicated patterns arise with a source. But another butterfly, this one, has the top side completely black, and the other side of the same butterfly has this almost straight line, straight down the middle. And to me, it's almost inexplicable how a mechanism that can produce ripples of concentration there can produce an almost ruled straight line down the other side. It must have something to do with the diffusion of molecules, but we, curiously, it's a completely non-understood phenomenon. So the last few minutes, what I'll talk about now is the remaining point, and this is the so-called community effect. And the principle of this idea is the following, that we've talked about cells that receive signals as they come from one direction. But it turns out that another mechanism of signaling is one where cells receive an initial signal of one kind to get them going at a low level. And then what they do is to signal to themselves and enhance the response. So it's as if various of you received some indication that there was something happening, and then once you got that signal, you all had to put your hands up and show your neighbors that that you've got the signal, and that constitutes a message to all your neighbors that they must now respond in a particular way. So the idea is this, that these two pink cells have received received a signal, and they've just started following the muscle pathway, like heart muscle. But they're only pink because the concentration of black spots is very low. Now, if all of these cells in a group were to emit the same black spots, but they're next to each other, the concentration of those black spots is now enormously higher, simply because they are next to each other and they build up this concentration. And when that happens, the whole group collectively will then switch and progress to another kind of differentiation. In this particular case, it's muscle. Now, in this case, you really can't see anything. I can see quite well on the screen, but you can't. There are single cells which are essentially invisible, and they are sitting alone without any neighbors. And when you look at that, there's no response. Had there been a response, there'd be black spots showing a gene response. Now, when you have a lot of these cells together, and here is about 100 of them in a group, they're all marked with a lineage marker red, and when you look for the response, here are the black spots. So all of those cells have turned on a gene, the muscle gene, only because they were present in this large community together. So that is the concept of a community effect. And it does matter. So that when they signal to each other, you get something like a tenfold increase in the response. Now I show another picture, and this is a fiendish fish, you may be able to see, which lives in the deep water, and it has a light organ here. It has this sort of projection which is very brightly colored. In fact, it emits light. And what happens is that the light attracts prey, which this fiendish animal then gobbles up. Now, what is the relevance? It turns out that this process has a name called quorum sensing. It means that the quorum, enough of them, working together produce a result. And the explanation for this is the following, that in that light organ, there are bacteria. And they live there, and the bacteria cause the turning on of a gene that emits light, Lux gene. The interesting thing is that for that to happen, you need to have an exceptionally high concentration of these bacteria, something like 1,000 million per mil, whereas when there's a much lower concentration of a few hundred per mil, that is insufficient to activate the bacteria to turn on the gene. And they even know the name of the chemical, which is called a homoserine lactone. And the principle here is that the concentration of bacteria in that space signal to each other to then cause the turning on of this gene, which only happens when there are enough of them actually working together. So what we call the community effect in development and creating cells, like organs, like the heart muscle, depends on this community effect. And unknown to me at the time when we worked that out, the bacteriologist had worked out this process of the homoserine lactone working for quorum sensing. So that the concept here is a fairly general one in science, and it makes the point that for cells to actually follow a particular fate, you need the combination of the two processes. So here is a diagram to indicate that if you have, I can barely read it, at the top, you have a concentration of this factor, which I've been talking about, called activin, ranging from about 3 to 10 to 30 picomolar, different three times fold concentrations, only threefold changes. At this concentration, followed by the community effect, all of those cells now switch on a gene called myodine, that's shown as a black spot. And likewise, they'll turn on cardiac actin, the muscle actin, at that concentration. But if you start them off at a higher concentration here, only threefold different, then when they communicate with each other, they will then turn on the gut gene, the endodermin gene. So it means that the principle is that it's the combination of a signal from some source going through like a morphogen action and then being amplified by the cells that receive that signal, then signaling again to themselves to enhance the original effect. And you end up in this way with organs like we have, the heart and so on, but it does depend on this sequential kind of signaling. So now let me first summarize what I've said at some length, and then finally I'll give you a bottom line. So I'm going to have to read this because that light's in the way. What it says is, reading from the top, an embryo is usually formed by a maternally created first axis, the mother fixes that, followed by an environmentally induced second axis, such as sperm entry. And the second point is that cells, tissues, and organs are formed by a combination of first the asymmetric distribution of determinants at cell division, and secondly, by signals from other cells. The morphogen gradient interpretation is an important mechanism for activating gene expression in the correct position. And lastly, the community effect converts gene expression into final cell types. Now, you'll probably say, or other people may say to you, what did the man say in this 45 minutes of lecture? And they always expect a bottom line. So I'm giving you a bottom line in case you have no idea what I've talked about at all. And so what this is a bottom line. It's a biblical statement. You may recognize it. It says faith, hope, and charity, and the greatest of these is charity. Now, the embryologist would say space, time, and concentration, and the greatest of these is concentration. So the bottom line is concentration. And finally, let me just say that the people whose work I've referred to, colleagues Stephen Dyson, Perry Burillo, Jerome Julian, and I've been kindly given videos by my colleagues Andrea Brand, Magdalena Zernicker-Gertz, and were supported by the Wellcome Trust. Thank you for listening.
And you had the snails up there, and you had those, when you had the snails up there, and you had those four levels. The second to last level was all sinister, dexter, I don't remember which. And then the last one, it was made up of recessive, dominant, recessive, and dominant, they were all the other direction. But you explained it all the way down, but if you explained it, I didn't get it. But what is the last line there when they're I don't know what they call it, heterogeneous or something. But they're mixed with the big D's and the small. The last line on that slide. Are you following this?
I think I can. Let me try to contribute to your point. It did look a rather forbiddingly complicated picture, but the basic principle was this: that the genetic constitution of the mother
which is variably described as little dd or big D little d or big D big D, determines the dextrality. D stands for dextrality. So the principle is that if it's a capital D, that's for dextral. It's a dominant gene, so if it's big D, little d, that also means dextral. Only if it's a little d, the double recessive, does that make it sinistral. And the point of the diagram was that the only thing that actually decides the coiling or the shell pattern of the offspring is the genetic constitution of the mother, not the genetic constitution of the snail itself. And that was the complication, because normally we think that if we have genes that will of a certain kind, that will determine what we are, and that is indeed the normal situation. But it was very confusing at the time that this absolutely didn't apply. It only depended on the genetic constitution of the mother, not of the mother and father as it would with us. And I might add that the case was even more complicated because they chose to do experiments with snails, which have the extraordinary disadvantage of being prepared. One snail will mate with another snail, but amazingly enough, the snail will self-fertilize itself, so it mates with itself when it feels like it. And that is quite extraordinarily complicated.
Hermaphroditic, yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't, if you were designing experiments, you would never, ever start with snails that can self-fertilize or cross-fertilize. And indeed, no one's ever done experiments with snails again, as far as I know of that kind, so for a very good reason. So it's, if you imagine it, and you didn't understand anything about maternal inheritance, it's really quite amazing that this was worked out. So the basic principle is that once you understand that only thing that matters here is the genetic constitution of your mother, and your father is completely irrelevant, then the whole thing makes sense.
But in your last line, have them all in the same direction.
Yeah, they were all right-handed. Opposite, yes.
But it was the opposite of the previous line, the opposite of the line of mother, of all of that generation.
They were all dextral, right-handed.
And the ones above were all sinistral?
The dextrals all came from a mother which was herself sinistral, but had the genetic constitution of being right-handed. So she became sinistral because her mother had that constitution. And she, as a daughter, then got a right-handed constitution to ensure that all her progeny were right-handed snails.
Constitutional conference.
But I didn't invent the way snails work, but that's how it is, actually.